Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Pope Benedict XVI addresses city administrators on the Capitoline Hill and warns against all forms of cultural and racial discrimination. And the Pope calls for a renewed commitment to respect the dignity of all women. Film critic Peter Malone tells us about Clint Eastwood's latest effort, a work that opens up many questions for contemporary society. And Benedictine abbot Timothy Wright has a special Lenten meditation for those who are bereaved. Benedict XVI has warned forcefully against all forms of racial and cultural intolerance and discrimination. The Pope was speaking on Monday morning whilst attending an extraordinary sitting of Rome's Municipal Council.
Sono anch'io persuaso, come è la signor sindaco ha affermato, che attingendo.
I am certain, the Pope said, addressing Rome's mayor, that the city of Rome, with its rich history, moulded by Roman law and by Christian faith, will find the strength to enforce in all the respect for the rules of civil coexistence and the rejection of all forms of intolerance and discrimination. The Pope's appeal followed his considerations regarding the fact that the city of Rome is being called upon to respond to unprecedented cultural, social, and economic challenges because of the deep transformations of the past decades. These are challenges, the Pope noted, that the whole world is dealing with at this time in history. He noted that Rome has always been a welcoming city and in the past years has been increasingly populated by people who belong to different cultures and religious traditions. The Catholic community, the Pope said, will never fail to lend its strong contribution in finding and implementing just rules and regulations in the safeguard of the human person within the respect of legality. And Pope Benedict went on to say that recent episodes of violence, deplored by all, are the manifestation of a deep unease. They are the sign, he said, of a real spiritual poverty that afflicts the heart of contemporary man. The elimination of God and of his law as a condition for human happiness, the Pope explained, deprives man of his spiritual certainties and of the hope he needs to face everyday difficulties. And the Pope ended his discourse speaking of the hope represented by children and by young people, and he expressed his appreciation for a new project sponsored by the Mayor of Rome that aims to become an observatory for religious freedom. Pope Benedict, who arrived at the town hall, which is located on Rome's Capitoline Hill, was welcomed by Mayor Gianni Alemanno. It was the first such visit by Pope Benedict XVI, and it follows that of his predecessor, Pope John Paul II, back in 1998. After pronouncing his address, the Pope appeared at the loggia on Palazzo Senatorio to greet citizens gathered in the square below.
Benedicat vos omnipotens Deus, Pater et Filius et Spiritus Sanctus. Grazie per la vostra presenza, arrivederci, buona settimana.
And the Pope ended his busy morning with a visit to the nearby monastery of St. Francesca Romana at Tor de Specchi, where he paused in adoration before the Blessed Sacrament and venerated the saint's body in the chapel of the choir. Meanwhile, Pope Benedict XVI has also called for a renewal of the commitment to respect the dignity and vocation of all women everywhere. The Pope was speaking Sunday on the occasion of International Women's Day after praying the midday Angelus in St. Peter's Square. And during his address to the faithful, he also emphasised the need for prayer as means of spiritual growth. As Lydia O'Kane reports, the Pope spoke about his retreat last week, noting that during a time of silence and prayer, the mind and heart are able to dedicate themselves entirely to God, to listening to his word, to meditating on the mysteries of Christ.
Having finished a week of spiritual exercises in silence and prayer, Pope Benedict was back in the public eye on Sunday for the Angelus against the backdrop of a sunny March day in St. Peter's Square. During his Angelus address, he focused his attention on the week-long retreat, saying this period of silence and prayer followed the example of Jesus, who brought the disciples to a high mountain in the Gospel story of the Transfiguration, adding that the transfiguration of Jesus was substantially an experience of prayer. Underlining the importance of prayer and contemplation in our spiritual lives, he urged the faithful in St. Peter's Square in this Lenten season to find moments of silence and reflect on life in the light of God's love.
And since the second Sunday of Lent, the Gospel invites us to ponder the mystery of Christ's transfiguration, to acknowledge him as incarnate Son of God, and to follow him along the way that leads to the saving mystery of his cross and resurrection. During this Lenten season, may you grow closer to the Lord in prayer, and may he shed the light of his face upon you and your families.
After reciting the Angelus prayer, the Holy Father spoke about the important role of women in society in reference to International Women's Day, celebrated on March the 8th.
8 marzo ci invita a riflettere sulla condizione della donna.
How many women, he said, work every day in obscurity for the good of humanity and for the kingdom of God. He also added that the testimonies of female saints like Mother Teresa of Calcutta were more important than pontifical documents in demonstrating humility and charity, and he pledged his prayers for all women, that they may always be increasingly respected in their dignity and valued in their positive capabilities. The Pope then turned his attention to his forthcoming visits to Africa and the Holy Land. Speaking about his visit to Africa from March the 17th to 23rd, the Holy Father said he would be going to Cameroon and then to Angola to demonstrate his closeness and that of the Church to the Christians and populations of that continent, which, he added, was particularly dear to him.
Dall'8 al 15 maggio compierò un pellegrinaggio in Terra Santa.
And looking towards his pilgrimage to the Holy Land, which he stated would be from May 8th to 15th, he said he would ask the Lord in visiting the places sanctified by his earthly passage for the precious gift of unity and peace for the Middle East and for all humanity. He also asked for the spiritual support of all on these apostolic journeys. I'm Lydia O'Kane.
Thanks there to Lydia O'Kane for that report. As Lydia was reporting, a good part of the Pope's thoughts were for women and their often difficult predicaments on Sunday the 8th of March, the day we celebrate International Women's Day. And so were the thoughts and the efforts of many international and church-related organisations. Caritas Internationalis, for example, chose the 8th of March to launch a new global campaign aimed at stopping 800 children from dying daily from AIDS. Emma McCarthy spoke to Monsignor Bob Vitillo, Caritas Internationalis's special advisor on HIV and AIDS and head of Caritas International Delegation in Geneva.
Why has Caritas Internationalis chosen to highlight the plight of children suffering from HIV/AIDS and their access to paediatric care, testing and treatment on International Women's Day?
Caritas Internationalis has been engaged in the struggle against HIV and AIDS for now over 20 years. So it's based on our experience, especially of the Caritas organizations, of the religious orders, and of other Catholic organizations in the field, that we highlight the special situation of children living with HIV as well as with TB. The fact is that for HIV, we've made great progress in the world in getting more access to the life-saving antiretroviral medications for adults. And now, even in poor countries, up to 30% or more of adults living with HIV have access to these medicines and are able to live longer and have a better quality of life. But we have not made as much progress with the situation of children living with HIV and with TB. Those children will die before, most of them will die before they reach their second birthday. And some of the problems involved here are the fact that there are not as many different medicines available for use with children. And also, many of the medicines that we have for antiretroviral treatment are not available in formulations and in dosages that are appropriate for use with children. So that in many places, doctors have to give one large adult pill to a mother and tell that mother to break the pill into six parts and guess on what the right dosage for the child will be. So the whole purpose of this campaign is, first of all, to encourage pharmaceutical companies, governments, research institutes to do more research to get better medicines and better formulations available for the children, and then also to open up access to these medicines at affordable costs for those children who are affected by HIV and TB living in poor countries. The reason why we decided to launch the campaign on International Women's Day is that, first of all, we know the very, very special relationship between most mothers and their children. And with women living with HIV, there's a great danger that they could pass the infection on to their child, both while the child is still in the womb, during the birth process, or even after birth when they're breastfeeding the child. And one of the pillars of this campaign is to promote better access to the prevention of mother-to-child transmission of HIV. And that's possible to do by using some of these same antiretroviral medications with the mother, one dose before she gives birth to the child, and then one dose of these medications to the child after the child has been born, within 72 hours after birth. When we do that, we could drastically decrease the possibility of a mother infecting her child with HIV.
Monsignor Vitillo, very basically, how expensive are these antiretroviral drugs that are life-saving for these women and children? How expensive are they to manufacture, first of all, to the best of your knowledge? And how much are, you know, countries being charged, or agencies, medical agencies, aid agencies being charged for these drugs?
Well, this is also an excellent question. How much it costs to actually arrive at the medication, it's hard to really estimate, because many pharmaceutical companies tell us that it costs a great deal to do the research in the development of these medications. But the fact is that much of this type of research is funded by governments and not by the pharmaceutical companies themselves. And yet the pharmaceutical companies often put on a very high price, especially after they've first patented the medicines and those patents are in effect for 25 years. So this is a real problem, that sometimes we have a much higher cost than really is justified for these medications. The second thing is that with the adult medications, because now with the special programs of the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria, and also the United States President's Emergency Program for AIDS Relief, there's a lot more marketing that is going on. There's a lot more purchase of these medicines, and so they've been able to negotiate the prices down for the adult medications. But because not that many children's medications exist, the prices still are quite high, and it still could cost between 8 and 12,000 euro per year to treat one child in the northern countries, in the high-income countries. That's an impossible price to think of to treat children in the developing countries. And that's why, once again, we need to have less costly formulations of these medicines, and we also then need to be able to get more children having access to these medicines so that the costs will go down in the developing countries as well.
You've been listening to Monsignor Bob Vitillo, Special Advisor on HIV and AIDS for Caritas Internationalis, talking to Emma McCarthy. Thank you. And now we go over to our friend, film critic Peter Malone, who heads the film office at CIGNUS, the World Catholic Association for Communication. If you listened last week, you would have heard Peter introduce himself and speak with passion of a lifelong interest and professional expertise in cinema. Today he tells us about the impressive film, acted and directed by an impressive figure in the history of film, Clint Eastwood. The film is called The Gran Torino, and its screenplay by Nicholas Schenck opens up many questions for contemporary society, especially xenophobia. Clint plays a bad-tempered and apparently prejudiced Walt Kowalski, who ends up sharing in the lives of those who are initially detested or condemned. And as Peter himself leads us to understand, this is the first of a series of films on current release dealing with racial and cultural prejudice.
I'd like to start the theme of xenophobia with a film that's on major release all over the place, and that's Clint Eastwood's Gran Torino.
Right. Which I discovered is a motor car.
It is, yes. Actually, I'm not too hot on that too. I had to be informed, but apparently very strong in the 1970s. And the film is set in Detroit, the home of the car. And Clint Eastwood's character used to work in the factory and is a bit upset because one of his sons now works as a publicist for overseas-made cars, which doesn't impress him in the least.
Okay, so his character is Walt Kowalski. I've read that it sometimes seems like a relic of different and distant times in the sense that he reminds us maybe a little of Dirty Harry.
He does. Well, there's nothing like Clint Eastwood glaring and glowering at anybody. And I don't know whether I can do it on air, but I've never heard anybody growl so much on the screen that he makes a face and he...
Ever notice how you come across somebody once in a while you shouldn't have messed with? That's me.
And he's going like that so often during the film. So, in a sense, it's that Dirty Harry tradition, because his character actually fought in Korea 20 years even before Dirty Harry. So there's that accumulated American wariness because of World War II and the Korean War, let alone Vietnam, which makes him automatically suspicious of anybody that looks like what used to be the enemy.
What the hell these Chinese have to move in this neighborhood for?
So, the xenophobia in this contest is towards...
It's actually towards a group of Hmong.
Yes,
the people from that corner of Laos, China and Vietnam who fought with the Americans in Vietnam. And they make the point, because they're his neighbours in the street now. In fact, the old grandmother looks at him and says with subtitles, you know, wouldn't you think he would have moved out to go with the whites, which is the reverse of, I suppose, what he was thinking. Wouldn't they go out and mix with themselves? But they explain that because they fought with the Americans, then they had to leave Vietnam, but were not so welcomed when they came to the United States or in places like Detroit. So that's the setup of an old man, because Clint himself was 78 when he made it, with that kind of history, looking at the Asian now citizens, as well as the gangs from the Hmong clashing with the African-American gangs in Detroit. So you've got that very tense kind of setting.
Get off my lawn.
You better watch your back.
Thank you.
I heard there was some trouble in the neighborhood. Why didn't you call the police?
I prayed that they would show up, but nobody answered.
So it's really a fear of today's multicultural society that they represent, isn't it?
It is. The interesting thing about the film and about Clint Eastwood himself is that you know by the end of the film that he is going to be friendly with the neighbours, but it's watching how the change takes place.
Why are you bringing me all this garbage anyway?
Because you saved Tao.
I didn't save anybody.
You're a hero to the neighborhood.
I'm not a hero.
And in fact, you mentioned Dirty Harry. I thought it was going to have a kind of Dirty Harry, vigilante, gung-ho ending, and it doesn't. And it seems to me a very interesting reflection of how Clint Eastwood over the last 30 or 40 years as a man representing I suppose, justice, law and order often, as well as his Italian days as the man with no name, is actually handling this kind of multicultural and intercultural friendship and what he can do for others.
We're having barbecue. You want to come over? We've got beer too.
I might as well drink with strangers.
By the end of it, I was actually even more impressed, but I better not spoil anything about the plot and let you see it.
What was it like to kill a man?
You don't want to know. Tao and Sue are never going to find peace in this world, as long as that gang's around.
What are you going to do, Walt?
Whatever it is, they won't have a chance.
Clint Eastwood is the lead player in the film. Is he also the director in this film?
He is, yes. He's since he turned 70, it seems to me that he's been excellent in the films that he's directed. So when you think of this one and Changeling with Angelina Jolie.
Right, that was also up for an Oscar, wasn't it?
It was. And then the two films about Iwo Jima, mm-hmm. Flags of Our Fathers, yes. And Letters.
Yes.
And then he won an Oscar for Million Dollar Baby and Mystic River in 2003. So they're his most recent films, which I was impressed. I read this morning, in fact, that the Cannes Film Festival has awarded him a Life Award, and that seemed sensible enough, till it mentioned that the only other director in their history that they have given such an award is to Ingmar Bergman.
Goodness me,
He's certainly assumed a status in film directing up there with Bergman.
So good for Clint Eastwood. We'll go and see that as well.
Good.
Okay. Thank you very, very much indeed. You've been listening to Peter Malone, head of the Film Office at Cygnus, the World Catholic Association for Communication. And now, in the second week of Lent, the 40-day period of penance that leads to Easter, Benedictine abbot Timothy Wright has a special thought for those who are in mourning.
My second thought for Lent is, I call it Lent for the bereaved. There are many, many people who, for no fault of their own, find themselves entering Lent already saddened, already diminished, already lacking in confidence that or hope for the future. They've lost a loved one, a partner in marriage. They've lost a child. Or they've lost a family through violence and war. Or they've lost a community or a support. Let me give you a little example. My monastery in England has been running parishes for centuries. And I had a letter from a parishioner recently saying how sad he was to hear that my community was pulling out of his parish after over 200 years serving it. What a gap that has left, and the thought has left a big hole. Not to say that our successors won't be better at it than we were, but it is a bereavement. And there are many other situations like that. In other words, the sense of loss is not just for 40 days during Lent. The sense of loss accompanies us daily, monthly, yearly. Sometimes we never get out of it. Please God that many of us will, as time passes and new experiences come our way and new friendships, etc. But nevertheless, the reality of the present is one of deep anxiety, a huge sense of loss, a great vacuum of emptiness deep in our heart. And that is an experience that we can take into our Lenten observance, because it relates very closely to what the disciples must have felt as Jesus was arrested, tortured, exploited, abused, and eventually put to death. And in that experience of the one who had the good news, the bright light, the hope for the future, was suddenly not there, and the silence of the tomb and the emptiness in that silence of the presence in which they had put so much trust and hope. It is precisely that experience which the disciples had and Mary his mother had. That is the experience that relates most closely to those of us bereaved at whatever cause and whatever sense of loss. In Lourdes there is a new Stations of the Cross, and one of them is what they call Holy Saturday. Mary pondering the dead Jesus, waiting in silence, remembering the tomb. And it is that moment which is for us a Lenten experience in itself, to live our Lent alongside death, alongside the silence of death, the emptiness of death, the annihilation which is death. And then not to end there, but to realize, however faintly, however slightly, that that is not the end, because Christ rose on the third day. And our Lenten experience of bereavement is a passing moment. It may last longer than 40 days. It may last years. It may last 2 or 3 years of Lent. But nevertheless, it is not the end, because the end is resurrection. The end is that that life, that hope returns, but not just as we expected it in the past, in a new, enlarged, enriched way, a way that is compulsively attractive. It is something that speaks to the heart and the mind, and which enlarges our spirit and energizes us to go out and recognize that that moment of bereavement was merely the anteroom to something greater. And that, in that Lenten experience, it's never an end on itself. It is, as I say, that anteroom to something greater. We just cling to that truth while sitting, pondering our bereavement, pondering in the cold silence of emptiness, that there is, on the other side of the door, life and hope. That is the resurrection. And Lent is a time, through our bereavement, where we can enrich our longing for and our trust in the hope which is life fulfilled in love through the risen Christ. Amen.
That's all from the English feature program today, and from me, Linda Bordoni. But we'll be back at this same time tomorrow, so join us then. You can also listen to our programs on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English program. Laudetur Jesus Christus.